Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Hello, I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
And I'm Joshua.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys who love the classic Doctor Who series, and we try our best to love the new series, too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. So, starting, as always, with round one, Temporal Grace. As fans, we sometimes get a little curmudgeonly about the show we love. That's why each podcast we're going to open with something that makes us happy about Doctor Who. Kelvin, do you want to start?
There's a Twitter feed called Classic Doctor Who 24/7. And most of the posts on it are behind-the-scenes photographs of the original series, you know, production things, obscure promotional photographs and things like that. And about a month ago, they posted one that I really loved, and it was pictures taken of the day Tom Baker was informed that he was cast as Doctor Who.
Oh.
And at the time, Tom Baker was very, very unemployed as an actor, and he was actually working on a road construction site, or some kind of building site or something. He was working as a hod carrier, which is like the guy who moves the bricks. Basically, he's the guy like, we need more bricks here, Tom. And so he like, okay, he just carries the bricks over. So it's a picture of him being like, wearing like these dirty, cheap clothes. And he's all dirty in the face and he's like really happy looking.
As you would be.
As you would be. And then there's like just a picture of him posing with the guys he's working with.
The other road crew.
The other road crew building construction guys. And it's really funny because he's a foot taller than all of them. It was really cool that was captured on film.
I just recently, it's been out for a while, but purchased the Fifth Doctor box set from Big Finish, who does audio adventures of Doctor Who. And the big selling point of this Fifth Doctor box set is that it was the first audio to feature Matthew Waterhouse as Adric, returning to the role after...
I didn't know he'd done that.
80 years, however long it has been.
I thought he wasn't going to do anything.
No, he came back, and so I picked up this box set, and it is really quite good. There are two stories in it. There's Psychodrome, written by Johnny Morris, which takes place immediately after Castrovalva, and Iterations of I by John Dorney, which takes place after Black Orchid. And they're really quite fun stories. The dialogue's very clever and pretty referential, but the stories stand on their own. They aren't just continuity fest. But of course, the biggest deal is that Matthew Waterhouse is returning to the role of Adric. And the cool thing is they don't attempt to retcon the character and suddenly make him cooler or even that much better than he originally was. He's still kind of a grumpy teenage genius who whines a lot, but they do take a little bit of time to put his behavior and attitude in context.
Nice.
So it's quite a lot of fun. I would highly recommend it. It does take a little getting used to the fact that he is now, I don't know, 65. I don't know how old he is. And he's playing this teenager. So he's pitching his voice a little higher, yet you can kind of get a little of that huskiness underneath it. There are times when it does hit a sort of Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs quality. But
great.
I'm trying to sell this. It puts the lotion in the TARDIS. But once you get past that little weirdness, it is a lot of fun, and I would highly recommend it.
All right, I'll check them out. So partly because the randomizer told us that we were going to watch and discuss The Reign of Terror for this episode, I just in the last few days reread one of my favorite Doctor Who texts, pieces of fiction ever, Kim Newman's novella, Time and Relative.
Yeah.
I've read a lot of Kim Newman in my time, and I like him a lot. And this is, for viewers or for listeners who might not know it, this is one of my favorite Doctor Who stories ever. It might be my favorite First Doctor adventure. It is, in any case, the best fictional depiction of Susan by far.
Oh, interesting.
So it takes place immediately before An Unearthly Child, while the Doctor and Susan are pretending to, you know, be humans on Earth, and she's going to Coal Hill School, and Ian and Barbara are in the background there. They're mentioned as Mr. Chesterton and Miss Wright, but it's a story that takes place before An Unearthly Child. There is an alien invasion of a sort that I won't really give away, but it's extremely well written. It's in the form of Susan's diary. It's a first-person narration. It's and 100 pages of big text, I don't know, something like 40,000 words.
Yeah, it's like
long.
A novella, isn't it?
Yes,
yeah.
It's very, very short. It's full of period 60s detail. It has a great teenage girl voice at the center of it, and it does a lot more with Susan than was ever done on the TV show. Poor Carol Ann Ford. I'm sure we'll talk a lot about this when we get to Reign of Terror later on. But for those of you who don't know it, Time and Relative by Kim Newman, one of the best Doctor Who books I know of. They're still available on eBay for not much more than it was when it was first released.
Good.
So
cool. Great.
More things to spend my time and money on. Thanks, Pat.
And now it's time for round two, Special Topics Dalek. Today I'm going to surprise these other guys with a question.
Oh, man.
So recently I got an email from a student who goes to my alma mater, the University of Redlands in Southern California. She is writing her senior thesis on the professional fan, specifically in Doctor Who. And because I've edited a certain number of academic books that talk in part about Doctor Who, her instructor told her to email me with my opinions.
Wow.
I know, right? That's me. That's me plugging my myself. But this is a very cogently expressed question, and I thought it was perfect to bring to a Special Topics Dalek.
Neat. Okay.
So what she asked was whether we believe that the recent series has suffered or benefited from fiddling with some of the key mysteries of the show, such as the Doctor's identity and the name of the Doctor, complexities of the TARDIS and the Doctor's wife, and journey to the center of the TARDIS, the recent glimpse of the Time War during the 50th anniversary special. Do we think it's important to preserve the enigma that is the Doctor and his world? The way she sees it, these mysteries serve their purpose in attracting audiences and keeping the attention of the fans, but they've also been known to foster seeds of contention between viewers and producers as to how the topics are approached and handled in canon. So what are our thoughts about this interesting and complex question?
Wow, does it have to be essay form?
Yeah. Wow, yeah. Like.
But boiled it down, it's like, what do we think about the mysteries of the Doctor?
Well, I like the Doctor being mysterious. I don't like it when writers kind of use that mysteriousness as an excuse just to suddenly give the Doctor some sort of paranormal ability.
Like he can do anything because he's a Time Lord? Like he he has a respiratory bypass system? Mm-hmm. Or
well, you know, there's always that kind of hint that Time Lords are sort of telepathic and have kind of, like, can kind of perceive how time is supposed to happen.
Yep.
And then somehow expanding that into
superpowers.
Yeah, like what happened in The Last of the Time Lords when, like, somehow he sucks all the psychic energy of everyone.
Flies across the room.
And flies across the room in this Jesus-like way and things. And like,
yes. It takes away a lot of mystery while being mysterious as to why they chose to do that. I guess I would argue that I think ways that the new series depletes the mystery is less about the TARDIS or the Time War or other story elements and more how the Doctor's portrayed. I don't think it's any huge secret here that I'm not a huge fan of David Tennant and the 10th Doctor and the whole era, and I think making the Doctor seem more like a everyman and a just sort of a romantic hero figure takes a lot of that mystery out. He seemed very human to me. Mm. And there's where I think some of that mystery is lost in the new series. Mm-hmm. I think you can't force the mystery back in. I think they tried that in the 25th season with Sylvester McCoy, where they tried to retroactively put the mystery in. To a certain extent, this character has been around so long, it is he's not an enigma, and the mystery can come off really forced if you try too hard.
That was largely my opinion, too. I sort of feel that the idea of the Doctor Who universe, or the Doctor personally as being mysterious or having a mystery at the core of him, is kind of overstated and a bit of hype, right? To me, it seems like a more recent post-Lost phenomenon, mm-hmm. like you want to decode or you want to have gradual revelations about mysteries at the heart of the show, which was not how the classic series operated usually. It tried to introduce those elements, as you said, in the Cartmel era, where they essentially were implying that the Doctor was God in Silver Nemesis.
In Silver Nemesis, yes. They implied he was a figure from Time Lord history
in Lung Barrow and stuff.
Daleks. But in Lung Barrow they did, but they started in Remembrance of the Daleks when he's talking about how he was there in the beginning with Omega.
Yeah, and those, they're fine suggestions or whatever, but for me it's kind of like not what the show is about. To introduce at this point new layers of the mystery is only to just kind of undo what has gone before, right? We're not talking about the War Games now, where there was huge areas of undefined doctorness that you could fill in with the Time Lords and regeneration and stuff like that. That's all been established now. So to do anything else like that, you have to undo something that's gone before. Or you play with marginal areas, like the relationship of the Doctor and his TARDIS, like Neil Gaiman does in The Doctor's Wife, that have always been sort of implicit in the show, that you can bring to the forefront for one episode and then revert to what the status quo was. You can have the TARDIS exist as a living being in the world for an episode to play with all of the suggestions that have always been there in the show. But that can't be the new status quo. It always has to go back to where it was before. So yeah, this idea of mystery at the heart of the show, I think it's a very intriguing question, but it's not one that I spend a lot of time thinking about exactly. I sort of want to see how the Doctor gets on with things. I want to see how he exists in the story world and what he does, not to have something revealed about him that we didn't know before.
And I mean, we get the little mystery every time he regenerates. What slight variation or version of the Doctor are we going to get? What characteristics are going to come to the forefront? So it does rejuvenate itself, and a little mystery is rejuvenated each time he does that. And we're in that slight mystery territory again with Capaldi.
They continue to, especially now in this new season 8, introduce questions about what the Doctor's character is like and what he might do. They've spent a lot of time talking about the darkness of Peter Capaldi and what he's capable of and compared to other Doctors. But that's sort of an interesting question, too, because the Doctor isn't going to be super villainous. Yeah. I mean, there are parameters beyond which he's no longer a recognizable hero. He's no longer the Doctor. So in advance, you already sort of know what those limits are, even if an individual story might go up to the edge and then pull back, like a lot of the Peter Capaldi stuff has been doing now with his perceived callousness towards some of the minor characters that keep getting killed. but again, I don't think there is really a fundamental mystery about the Doctor anymore. We know who he is after this point, and if it's changed too much, then he's no longer the Doctor that we want to watch a show about.
Yeah.
A lot of the new series, and the books were actually much better about this, they would push the edge of what the Doctor Who concept could be. The sort of dumbest example of that in the new series, to my mind, was The Doctor's Daughter, where they played with the idea of the Doctor being a father. Remember, Georgia Moffat played a character who the script insisted was the Doctor's daughter in some meaningful way, even though it was just somebody created out of his DNA or some nonsense or whatever. There's no meaningful way in which that character was the Doctor's daughter.
No.
But the script insisted upon referring to her as such in order to play with the newness of the Doctor being a father figure. Not, as you might guess, to my satisfaction. I don't think it was particularly good.
Yeah. It seemed like a publicity stunt. But they weren't, you know, if you're going to do that, commit to it.
Yeah, and Lance Parkin had done something similar but much better in Father Time, one of the BBC books, where the Eighth Doctor, during one of his tenures on Earth, adopted a daughter and raised her over the course of 18 years or whatever it was as his daughter. So that Miranda, I think was her name, was the Doctor's daughter in a much more meaningful way than the Georgia Moffat character from the Russell Davies episode. But it even Lance Parkin's book kind of avoided the central question about can the Doctor reproduce? What do Time Lords do? But it did. It was able to play in a more meaningful way with the idea of the Doctor as a father figure.
Russell Davies does that in a good way, and I'm going to blank which episode it is, but it's just a throwaway line in one of the Tenet episodes where Rose is surprised about the fact that the Doctor was a father at one time. Just going back to Susan and the idea that he had to have a granddaughter, he had to be a father first, and I'm... And geeks are screaming out there which episode. But I can't remember which one it was. But it was treated, again, not as a big dramatic scene, though, as a throwaway line, which is validated by the long narrative of the show, but isn't dwelled upon. So it tweaks a little mystery there, and you go, wow, the Doctor is a dad. But we don't delve into it, ruining the mystery.
Right. Yeah, it's going to bug me until I remember where that is
it's
from.
It's going to bug me, too. We better wrap up the segment so we can get on the internet.
Otherwise, we'll never know.
And now round three, the randomizer. In this round, we randomly choose an adventure from the classic series to discuss in the following episode. Today, as decided by our last episode, we'll be discussing The Reign of Terror.
That's my terrified noise.
This is from the first season of Doctor Who, and it is written by Dennis Spooner, and it is about the French Revolution.
Yep.
The Doctor's favorite period in history.
You know,
as we discover.
Yeah,
randomly.
When Susan declares that, my basic reaction was just, huh? Like, why would that be his favorite period in history?
Do they yell Allons-y a lot in the French Revolution?
Well, just, it seemed like a guy who is dedicated to, like, trying to create peace in the universe and things, like, would be, his favorite period in history would be this, like, violent overthrow.
Well, thing. It goes revolutionary, though. He starts revolutions wherever he goes.
He loves it.
It did kind
his
of...
usually have a few less beheadings.
Yeah. But it did kind of create this weird thought of, like, how you never see stories about the French Revolution where the revolutionaries are portrayed heroically.
Well, that's...
Which would be kind of a trick to do.
You know, but that's an interesting point to make, though, too, because this isn't about the early part of the revolution. This is about the Reign of Terror. So this is after the initial... revolutionary impulse has faded, and now it's starting to kind of eat itself. Specifically, this is about Tale of Two Cities era. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of thing that would have been familiar to British school children, the way Marco Polo would have been a few episodes earlier. This is pitched to kids or middle school people who would have known about this from their history class.
And I found that very interesting, is that it is written in a way that just expects everyone to just know right where they are.
They know
in
who Robespierre is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They don't really explain
today much. They'd have the Doctor in a new episode stop and explain it to his dumb young 20-something companions about what's going on currently in this point of history.
It's pitched in kind of a Tale of Two Cities way, too. It's not that, look at these horrifying poor people who are killing everybody and sending them to the guillotine. Barbara has some
that great
thing.
Moment, yeah, where
good,
she...
honest people supported the revolution, and you know, so it's pitched in this kind of middle of the road way. It's not critical of the revolution, but it's critical of the bloodshed that follows during this Reign of Terror period. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and she's pretty adamant in that scene. Her quote is, check your history before you decide what people deserve, when Ian is saying that.
Yeah, she yells at Ian.
He got what he deserved. But I mean, yeah. In that moment, you know, they were saving their own lives too when Leon was shot.
Yeah.
So it was another nice little moral clash.
Yeah, and it's one that's straight out of Tale of Two Cities. I'm going to keep hitting on that point too. But you know, Dickens in that is representing the revolution as something that was inevitable, considering what had gone before.
Well, yeah, and, I mean, you know, the French aristocracy were horrible.
Yeah, somebody had to chop their heads off.
They were, you know, horrible people. I mean, you know, just sucking kind of the life out of.
Yeah, and the revolution, country, you know. The revolution in Dickens' novel, as I remember, is portrayed as a force of nature. It's something that, like a hurricane or something, you know, mm-hmm. It's just like, it's going to happen. It was inevitable, and it did. But that didn't prevent Dickens, and it doesn't prevent the Reign of Terror here from criticizing the exuberant bloodshed that happens after the fact, the gratuitous guillotining and stuff.
Yeah. I don't know if it's historically accurate where they were saying, like, hundreds and hundreds of guillotining in the week. I think it's Robespierre who is quoting how many people, and even he's like, ugh. I don't know where to put all the heads.
Yeah, I don't know what the stats are on how many people got guillotined in a week, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, pretty bloody.
Yeah, so, and it's the doctor's favorite period in history.
Yeah, I'm just like, what?
It's clearly to me, that line strikes me as, again, an issue with historicals where it's, why don't you just turn around and leave? Mm-hmm. It's sort of thrown out there as a reason why there might be some delays or a conflict to keep them from just going right back to the TARDIS.
The best thing I could come up with was it's just an explanation of how the doctor can impersonate that government official so well.
Because it's his favorite period.
Because he knows more stuff than usual about how to, you know, BS being someone else or something.
It's fun seeing Bill Hartnell be a variation on his usual autocratic self.
Yes, it's a slightly different version of it.
Yes.
Just a more ostentatious hat.
But you're right about these historicals, Josh. It's like, what do they do ever in the historicals, right? They're witness to periods of history, but there's not a lot of agency that the Doctor or the Companions do. They don't. They take roles, but they don't affect any sort of change. They can't. Because history can't be rewritten even one line. They even refer to the Aztecs in this.
And the Doctor talks about that, you know, events will happen as they're written and they can't stem the tide, but at least they can stop being carried away with the flood. And that is really the conflict in every historical, is they get enmeshed in some historical event and they know what's going to happen and they know it's going to be bad and they know it's going to be ugly and they got to get the heck back to the TARDIS before it happens.
Yeah, and the drama is one of escape. They mm-hmm. get separated, and they get separated from the TARDIS as well, so they can't just, as you said, Kelvin, just kind of leave.
Yeah.
Stretched out over six episodes, it does seem a little touristic, right? They're just touring the Reign of Terror.
Well, we seem to be in this period of history. What do we do? Well, let's go see what's in this barn. Mm-hmm. And then someone hit me over the head. You know.
And then the inevitable appearance of Napoleon.
Yeah.
When you're here, right? It's like, oh, of course.
Let's just get Napoleon in here. Yeah. And they go to such a great degree to get Napoleon in there, where they're faking,
pretending to be bartenders. I love Ian at that point. You know who that was? That was Napoleon. It's like seeing Tom Cruise on the street. That was Napoleon.
His delight there is great. I mean, the fun of this episode, I think, is seeing all these characters in their early period.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there's such great scenes. I love the scene in the first episode where Barbara and Ian don't trust that they're in the right time period, so they don't want to just walk out of the TARDIS and let the doctor take off.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the doctor is just trying to shoo them out, and they kind of sweet talk them, and they both hang off of his shoulder, mm-hmm. and they mm-hmm. let's not end like this. And Ian's like, let's part over a drink.
That's my favorite part too. It's also always fun for me in these early episodes to see this kind of unstated love between Barbara and the Doctor. She's the one who really gets along with the Doctor and can talk him down from stuff like this.
Yeah.
So he comes just he's frothing at the mouth here. He's so angry right at the beginning. But she's the one who can start to soften him. And there's always these conversations between the two of them where he really cares about her and respects her opinion in a way that he'll clash with Ian, but he'll listen to Barbara. And I like watching that
a
lot.
It's a very nice dynamic. Mm-hmm. And then, as we've mentioned earlier, poor Susan has absolutely nothing to do but be afraid of things and get sick.
Oh. Yeah, she's like all scared of rats
and
oh
leeches.
Oh, my God, you guys.
And she gets
just Susan is
sick.
Just terrible. She's always terrible. It's these sexist Doctor Who writers at the time. They just had no idea what to do with her. She's constantly...
Oh, you know, she's a teenage girl, therefore she's helpless and scared of
everything. She's hopeless.
I mean, I know she's kind of officially considered to be, yes, actually a Time Lord, but I still kind of like the interpretation that she was like some orphan kid that the Doctor adopted when she was like super young and just kind of gave her the story like, well, you're my granddaughter.
Because she just doesn't jibe. But it's weird because... Yeah. Even Vicky right away is a stronger, better character
than
next go around.
No, Vicky's much better. It's like Susan Mark II, and they were able to do things with her that they never did with Susan.
She's smarter. She's funnier.
Yeah. She has agency. She'll do things on her own. Yeah. No matter how much I like some of these early episodes, Susan is always just a problem.
They just need to carry a fainting couch around.
There was
bind her ankles.
Yes.
Wasn't there like first time they tried to do an unearthly child and they had to go back and reshoot a bunch of stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Like they originally had the Doctor wearing a more contemporary suit.
Did they?
Yeah, like he was wearing like just kind of like a regular black suit and tie that was more modern
day.
Well,
I know in
England.
That first pilot he was sharper and scarier.
Yeah,
and
Susan was also different. They were going to do a thing where Susan was not of this world, like she was more mysterious and alienish, and for lack of a better term, hotter. You know, like you know, because that was like, you know, playing up this exotic quality, but then they decided that was like too much or something, so they just kind of scaled her way back.
Yeah, and not to keep beating the same drum, but Time and Relative, which I mentioned earlier, really splits that difference on Susan very well. And she's simultaneously a Time Lord from outer space and is not a human being and reacts to things in very strange and different ways, but is also a 14 or 15-year-old girl. The language that she uses in her diary there works that very, very well, which never happened in the show, unfortunately.
Yeah.
One other interesting thing that struck me watching this, and I think it was in the scene with Ian and Barbara, when Ian tells Barbara that Leon is dead and was a traitor, and they have their moral argument. There's something in these early season where you see this hint of the character the Doctor is going to become in both Ian and Barbara combined. That sort of heart and mercy of Barbara with that pragmatic sense of justice in Ian. And then as the show develops, that's going to be something that kind of is combined in the Doctor more. And in certain regenerations, one side comes out more than the other. But it's certainly something even all the way down to the new series we see him struggle with.
Yeah, it's interesting how they kind of empty out the character of the companions over the course of the years and put those qualities in the Doctor himself. Like here they're externalized in Ian and Barbara, as you say, because we don't know enough about the Doctor to know how he's going to react. So these are the two sides of his personality. And Susan.
And Susan, who's afraid of rats.
Right. There's a thing here, it's episode 2 or 3, where mostly you just see the Doctor walking down a road.
Yeah.
Inserts, he was on vacation probably.
Yeah.
According to extras, they just couldn't afford to have him rehearse any less. Because subtle implication that he wouldn't know his lines if they took him out of rehearsal.
Oh, dear.
And so they had an extra do the location.
I remember watching this. And, you know, like the Doctor gets out of the house fire and it's like, well, they took my companions to Paris. Well, then off to Paris I shall go. And then he just starts walking.
And
the first thing I think of is like, well, they're dead. Ian Barber and Susan are all executed.
And he's got
because there's no way this old guy walking down.
But his stroll is quite jaunty while he's walking down those paths. He's not too worried about him. He's just
yeah,
he's enjoying
worrying.
The countryside.
He's just like, oh, beetle, beetle. And then there's that the segment where, you know, he just sits down to rest by, what is it, like a prison?
Like a chain crew? Gang of some kind.
Yeah, like a French chain gang. And just by pointlessly being a crabby old guy,
he gets thrown into
jail, basically. and it's like, this serves no point except to make the story one episode longer.
Although it is quite entertaining to see him hit the guy with the shovel.
The straw hat, the Van Gogh straw hat. So I got to say something, too, about when they're in prison, the jailer sleazes all over Barbara.
Yes.
Like, everybody sleazes all over Barbara whenever she's around. She is constantly getting sexually...
sleazed upon.
Sexual advances by... It happens in the Crusades. It happens in the Romans with Nero himself, as I remember.
Yes.
That's a weird...
Well, it was too creepy to hit on Susan, so...
Yeah, because she's too young. But it's also something that doesn't really recur in Doctor Who. I mean it's
until
every
Perry
now and then,
again.
But Perry
well,
is
Perry got
Perry
hit
is
a
the
lot.
Big one. Yeah, it shows Jack and all the rest of them. They're like doing increasingly creepy things to her.
Yeah,
but for some reason, these first two seasons, Barbara is the target of unwelcome sexual advances by the bad guys, and this is weird to me for what's ostensibly a children's show.
Yeah,
in 1963, 1964.
They don't terribly dwell on it in this episode. It's right when they arrive at the prison.
It's not nearly as overt here as it is in some of the other historicals.
Yeah.
I note it only because it's so common and it's always with Barbara.
Yeah, and obviously in a prison setting, they could not dwell on it long.
Right.
It would get bad really fast.
Yeah, and so sex and sexuality in Doctor Who is probably a topic for another day.
I never realized this was the last episode of the season, though, too. And so it does end with that voiceover, and there's the starscape, and about the Doctor saying our destinies are in the stars. Let's go and find them.
Yep.
And,
and then they're going to be 3 inches tall.
Yes,
planet,
that's what I thought.
It's like, giants.
But first, let's get really small.
There we are. Reign of Terror this episode. But the randomizer says that next episode is going to be... The Time Monster.
Ooh! Ooh! Ooh!
Ooh!
Ooh! We might have to use the HADS on that one. The Hostile Action Displacement System.
Oh,
my dirty secret, which I'll tell next episode, is I love the Time Monster. It's great.
Right. Time Monster it is.
Time Monster it is.
Tom Tit.
And now round 4. Wonderful Afunctionalism. It's the holiday season, and the Doctor Who Christmas special is just around the corner, so we thought it might be fun to ask Pablo, the man behind our opening theme, to do a jazzy new cover of that timeless holiday classic, I Want to Spend My Christmas with a Dalek. But Pablo said, what about Hanukkah? It's a holiday that Doctor Who blatantly ignores every single year. So we decided to correct that little bit of cultural insensitivity. Ladies and gentlemen, Get Off My World presents A Very Dalek Hanukkah.
Hanukkah is sappy and occasionally crappy, but there's nothing much about it we can do. It was never a big deal until Santa took the wheel and tried to Christmas ties every mother-loving Jew. Now wouldn't it be bollocks if the last tribe were all Daleks and they came back just for Hanukkah through and through? They could buy us all the presents, make compliant all the presents, and exterminate the elves and Santa too. Festival of light will be burning extra bright from the flashing and the dashing of the death rays in each home. And when the Christmas cheer is wiped clean from ear to ear, they'll make us little cradles out of real human bone. Wouldn't it be bollocks if the last tribe were all Daleks and they came back just for Hanukkah through and through? They could
buy us all the presents, make compliant all the presents, and exterminate the elves in Santa too.
Now round five, the death zone, in which we will pit doctor versus doctor versus doctor versus doctor. You get the idea. In a battle to the end to decide who is the very best doctor. And as an added bonus, we have a guest for this round. It's our friend Mike, the unaffiliated critic. Say hi, Mike.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. And here's how we're going to do this. Because we're Doctor Who fans, we can't really settle on one favorite doctor. All we can do is say our two favorite doctors right now at 9:47 p.m. tonight. So take it with a grain of salt, but we're going to dig in right now, starting with Pat.
Thank you, Josh. My two favorite doctors as of this moment are Peter Capaldi and Peter Davison.
Oh. Somebody likes Peters.
Oh. Someone likes Peters.
I like Peters.
All right, we'll get back to more of a discussion in just a moment. Kelvin, your two favorites.
Tom Baker and Patrick Troughton.
Ooh.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
Mike.
Okay. Matt Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And Sylvester McCoy.
Nice.
Ooh.
Okay.
And now, I'm going to say something. I have no idea what it is. My two favorite doctors, with an imaginary gun to my head at this moment, would be...
Imaginary?
Peter Capaldi and Paul McGann.
Wow.
Wow.
I said it.
You
did.
Just
take the gun off my head and maybe it'll change.
Okay, I'll put this gun down.
Well, if you factor in all the audio adventures, well, sure.
I am.
I think Josh must be factoring in all the audio adventures.
Because what else can he do? Mm-hmm.
So expand on that, Josh.
Okay, so for starters, I'm just excited by Peter Capaldi because it's the first time in a long time, probably since Classic Who, where I have that childlike thing where I just am in love with the current Doctor, which was a thing when I was a kid. There are real reasons that I really like Peter Capaldi's performance. I think he is a throwback to the old school doctors. I like his temperament. I like his style of dress. I love the shtick of him not being able to recognize the differences between human beings or remember things from adventure to adventure. I find it hilarious. So I just am really currently in love with Peter Capaldi. You know, whether I love season 8 to death, up and down, that's a different story, but I'm really into Peter Capaldi. And for Paul McGann, who doesn't like an underdog?
Yeah.
And I was really taken with Night of the Doctor. That's sort of, I had a resurgence in my love of Paul McGann for that. A, it was a huge surprise. B, I thought he just kicked ass in that. It was hard to believe that was 7 minutes and how much, well, Stephen Moffat crammed into it in 7 minutes and how much character Paul McGann brought to it. Obviously, after doing years and years of Big Finish audios, which I also have followed and greatly enjoyed.
It took him about 30 seconds, though, to prove what a tremendous doctor he could have been. And
yeah.
Was lost.
It was definitely a little sad to see him, because you know he's probably not coming back to it, but it was a nice final moment. The fact that Night of the Doctor gave a canonical nod to the Big Finish companions, it sort of widened Paul McGann's tenure as the Doctor. So those are all things that are top of mind to me right now.
Well, I don't disagree with any of that.
No.
And, of course, I said that Peter Capaldi was one of my current favorite doctors. And I agree with everything that you've said. And I'm sure we'll have more to say about Peter Capaldi in a future or past episode. I'll make a little bit of a case for Peter Davison here, who is one of, I think, the more underappreciated doctors. As a kid, growing up watching Tom Baker, to see Peter Davison take over the role was very jarring. That was my first experience with, oh, this is a new doctor, and he's a radically new doctor. He suffered from some inferior scripts, but you could say that of all the doctors.
No doctor is immune to a weak script.
But fantastic ones, too. Some of the best of the series.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do really like the Fifth Doctor era on the whole. I mean,
Kinda and Caves of Androzani. I won't say anything about these because I think
spoilers.
they're just as good as everybody says they are. He was the first doctor I saw that really dealt with an ensemble cast, and I don't suppose that his ensemble was really all it could have been with Tegan and Nyssa and Adric and all that. But it is, in some way, the most current forerunner to a lot of what the new Who does, with the Doctor being the kind of center of the family that other people are reacting against. And he was a younger Doctor, and he was eccentric, and people didn't really quite know how to deal with him. And he wasn't an authority figure in the same way that some of the earlier Doctors had been. So you can see him as a precursor, as probably Matt Smith, particularly. Having said that, I think he's a little bit forgotten because there's nothing that really jumps out at a modern audience.
One thing I really appreciate about the Fifth Doctor is that he actually had some vulnerability. He had some degree of like indecision about, like, I don't really know what to do here. And I liked that a lot, actually.
He's also a doctor that wound up pointing guns at people a lot. this is a thing that happens in the new series a lot. Like, I'm a man of nonviolence or whatever, but I'm thrust into these situations where I have to make some violent choice.
Yep.
But Peter Davison is constantly pointing a gun at Omega or all these other things.
Davros.
The most pacifistic, or one of the most pacifistic of all the doctors, is constantly having to do this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think Peter Davison is tremendous. I think I actually knew him from All Creatures Great and Small.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
I loved it.
I thought he was great. I find his era almost unwatchable. And part of that, I think, is it's not just the scripts, and he did suffer from some poor scripts, but I think his companions are insufferable. I think we get into Tegan and Turlough and Adric, and it's... I have a lot of trouble with that era.
Now, I like Turlough a lot, but I won't disagree with what you're saying. Yeah.
What I liked about... what was I saying?
Tom Baker and Patrick Troughton.
Tom Baker and Peter Troughton. What I like...
They're all Peters. Peter Baker, the second Peter Baker, Peter McGann, Peter Eccleston.
Makes it easier to remember them that way.
Patrick Troughton. Jesus.
Peter Jesus.
I had a weird comment I was going to throw in about Peter Davison, and I forgot what it was, and it scrambled my brain. I'm sorry. Anyway, what I like about Patrick Troughton and Tom Baker is I think they did probably the best job of combining all the elements I think of as being part of Doctor Who, the genius, bravery, kindness, humor, all those various elements. I think they did the best job of having it all be seem to be like one personality and not like space bipolar disorder.
That's straight from a Terry Nation script, isn't it?
Is there a moment that you can think of that's representative of one or the other of them that's really like a Doctor Who moment or a handful of moments?
Well, one thing that really... one Patrick Troughton thing I always kind of get is like there's one scene in The Invasion. I can't remember. They're like running away from Cybermen and they like trip and fall and like someone is taking a picture of something and Patrick Troughton like literally just stops and kind of straightens his hair a little bit. And like, it was a nice little humorous moment and it didn't seem like forced, shoehorned in kind of humor. It just seemed, this is naturally what the Doctor would do in that situation.
Well, Mike, make a case for Sylvester and
make
Matt.
Make a case for my two unpopular choices.
I'm sorry, Peter McCoy and Peter Smith.
Peter McCoy and Peter Smith. Yeah, I mean, Matt Smith, and, you know, I admit right up front to being a new Who guy in the den of old Who here, but first of all, I would argue that Matt Smith is hands down the best actor ever to take the role. I think he's fantastic. And for me, he was the Doctor, like, right out of the box. And I, you know, when he appeared at the end of time and when I saw interviews with him when he was cast, I couldn't picture it working. And then it took about 10 minutes into the 11th hour before mm-hmm. it was like, bam, that's the Doctor. That's him. And what I love about his performance is, you know, because he is very young and he does act very childish, he's sort of this hyperactive child, but it's the contrast of that, the moments when you see the 900-year-old man shine through that. There's that tremendous speech at the end of The Big Bang when he's sitting beside young Amelia Pond's bed, and he looks like an old man. I mean, he looks like he's done at that point. It's just a fantastic performance. Sylvester McCoy, I pick partially to be provocative because I think mm-hmm. he does tend to get lumped in at the bottom of everybody's list with Colin Baker. I love that era. The last two seasons of the classic series is one of my favorite runs. The whole Ace arc. Part of that, again, I will admit, it's more like the new series than anything else in Classic Who. Right, there's a longer character arc going on. They were doing something really interesting with Ace. But I just love McCoy's performance. There's always so much going on behind his eyes. It's very restrained. He has this stillness to him, you know, always with that little twinkle and always that he's thinking about 50 things that he's not saying. I think it's a great performance.
Did you like him, though, out of curiosity, in his first season? Or did it take you to
this? I can't get past Mel in those first
two. Mel is a lot to get past.
Honestly. And there's some, you know, there's some interesting stuff going on there. I think the political satire stuff that they were doing at that point is fun, and there's some interesting stuff. But no, it's really once Ace gets there that he really clicks for me.
Right.
And that's something I think that happens with a lot of doctors. I mean, I think, you know, companions need to be with the right doctor and vice versa. I mean, I think Sarah Jane came alive more when she got with Tom Baker, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I think Clara has done that with Capaldi. And so I think that combination is important, and I think it's the Seventh Doctor and Ace that really gels for me.
Yeah, you might be among foes here, but you're not with Sylvester McCoy, I think. Josh, in particular, I think, is.
I mean, I remember watching that, Remembers of the Daleks, particularly. I was 17. I watched it when it first aired here in Minnesota, and the whole show just sort of came alive again for me. That opening shot of the Dalek ship and the planet and the radio broadcast from 1963, mm-hmm. and I was just like, what's going on? And I
and that spooky
loved
little girl,
it.
And that's such a good story.
Yeah, and it seems to be taking a kicking in fandom right now. It was so popular, obviously, toward the end of Doctor Who's run in fandom. Obviously, it wasn't popular or wouldn't have been canceled with mainstream audiences, but it's now very uncool to like, but I still really love those last two seasons.
I'll give it a kicking right now. I mean, not not much of one. It's only that was at the end of my initial enamorment with Doctor Who that I started to watch those, and the cheapness of it really started to show.
The change in the video quality is a little hard to get past. I admit that.
And Ace, I'll put a pin in this for future episodes, but a lot of the performances.
Pat has a lot of pins.
I've got pins all over me. So I won't say that I disagree with you guys that Sylvester McCoy is one of the best doctors, but then I think they're all the best doctor.
I really do. You've all persuaded me. Except for maybe David Tennant.
I knew that was going to come up. I knew that was going to happen. That, folks, is our show. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed it, please tell everyone you know, all your geeky friends, or, write a review on our iTunes page. And again, special thanks to Pablo Jones for our wonderful theme song, and to Tony Carna for recording all this stuff and making it sound all pretty. So, join us again next episode when we will be discussing the Third Doctor adventure, The Time Monster, yay, as selected on the randomizer. And also, for the Death Zone, we will be debating which is the best master. We'll be throwing all the various masters into the Death Zone and seeing who survives. And until next time, this is Kelvin.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Joshua.
And we're saying,
get off my world.
Now, Ian can get away with a tight shirt.